Welcome to episode 147 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas-Smith. This week we have Don Roberts and John Brandt of Refactoring Browser fame to talk about the Refactoring Browser, refactoring in general, SMAC, and a whole bunch of other things around that technology. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group at Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. This is James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Michael Lucas-Smith, the lead on our Web Velocity product.
G'day.
And also Don Roberts.
Hello.
And John Brandt.
Yes.
The famous parsing and refactoring guys.
At least in some circles.
Yeah.
Well, infamous, someone might say, yes.
Yeah.
Circles with very small diameters.
Yeah, well, it's like when people ask me how well-known I am, I like to tell people that I'm famous inside a very small closet.
It's a really interesting point when you say very small circles, people will recognize your names, despite the massive amounts of stuff you did for refactoring, and refactoring's everywhere now, not very well known outside of the right communities. And that's, I think that's a real shame. You need to write more books.
We hire people like Martin Fowler to do that kind of stuff.
Okay, so he can get all the fame and fortune. You guys can stay in the background out there in Urbana-Champaign.
I don't live there anymore, but I still live in Illinois.
Okay. All right, so why don't we kind of take this back to the beginning. You guys both got into Smalltalk back at Urbana-Champaign, correct?
Yes.
And that was working with Ralph Johnson?
Yep. We took object-oriented programming course with him in graduate school. And I can distinctly remembering about halfway through the course, basically deciding that, you know, Smalltalk's a toy language that you couldn't do anything serious with.
What changed your mind?
The latter half of the course, I believe.
Because I actually looked at Smalltalk probably in 1990 when I had a 386, in which first time I looked at it, this is like ObjectWorks 2.5, and you open it up, it takes over the whole screen, and you couldn't really do a whole lot in 4 megabytes of memory at the time. So kind of looked at it and kind of dismissed it. Then I got in Ralph's course and picked it up from there. So,
what was your first aha moment? Because I'll explain my first aha moment with Smalltalk, and it's probably not similar to yours because you guys are much smarter than me. My first aha moment was when I was using a dictionary and I accidentally put an object as the key. Prior to that, I had treated dictionaries more like hash tables that I'd done in C, where everything was keyed on an integer, basically. And I was using symbols too because they were unique. But then one day I accidentally put an object in the key, and I realized, oh, wow, it's just objects everywhere.
I think for me it was probably more along the lines of the point where, you know, you see the 3@2, and, you know, always before I just kind of assumed, oh, that's just, you know, the syntax for creating points. But then, you know, somebody goes and shows you, oh, here's the actual method, and you can go change it and do whatever you want with that. And like, wow, that's pretty cool.
That's probably up there with me. For me, it might have been the this context sender, change the message, send, and go. And it just worked.
Well, I mean, it takes you a while to get to this context in a course, so it seems like it took a while for you to get your major aha moment.
that was the difference between the toy language and the, holy crap, this is a whole system that you can play with while you're on the inside.
Yeah, I think I'm probably more prosaic than you guys then. I think my aha moment was way back when I remember seeing something in the debugger, and I had been a C programmer before this, and just realizing that not only could I fix the stupid bug, but I could just precede it.
Yeah.
That was pretty much where I turned around and decided I'd had enough of C.
So refactoring, right? Pretty big thing. What made you guys decide to make the refactoring browser in the first place?
Well,
a degree.
Yeah.
You have to do something to get out of school.
Yeah, that's right up there.
But yeah, it's kind of, you know, Ralph had always had the idea, and I liked to just working with Smalltalk, you know, from taking Ralph's course, and you know, I had worked on the refactoring with Bill Updike before he started, you know, and that was in with C++, but they could never build a tool. So about the time, you know, I started being a grad student for Ralph, was he, you know, he just started kind of the refactoring and going to build one for Smalltalk. So that's kind of, you know, you do whatever your advisor says kind of in grad school. But, you know,
that's almost the same as my story, because my master's thesis was actually on his Smalltalk compiler and doing register allocation by graph coloring and some little variation on that. And, I mean, he'd been working on this compiler for years, and as I was finishing up, I realized that he was not that interested in it anymore, mainly when it took me a week or two to get, you know, get him to sit down and read my thesis. And so I basically looked and asked him what he was interested in, and it was this weird refactoring stuff, and that was kind of where his interest lies, so I signed up.
And to me, I've always been a little bit interested in transforming source code. Even before I started, you know, the Smalltalk side, I had a tool that I wrote for Paradox, and they had their little PAL language, and it could go in and, like, transform that somewhat. So, you know, refactoring seems a natural fit for that.
Was this the refactoring browser? Did it kind of start off the way that we see it now, or how did it evolve into the current shape that we see it in?
Well, okay, so it started off, the first person that we can remember actually working on some kind of refactoring things, his name was Dan Wolkowski, but he left the university for money, and those of us who didn't care about money were in it for the more lofty goals, like a degree. We basically took that and continued, and he started off with basically just simple things like renaming, but all of his stuff was really string-based, and it doesn't take too long before you realize that the, you know, string search and replace, the wheels kind of fall off that cart pretty fast. And so about that time, John and I both got on the project, and we ended up building a standalone refactoring tool. And so you'd be working in the browser, and then you would go over and launch a tool all your refactoring stuff on it.
Yeah, Dan's tool is actually built into, I think he just added extensions to the browser itself. So the default browser, you loaded it, you changed the class variable that had all the menus in it, and went from there. But then from after that, we got the really bad idea of building a separate tool, and so that's kind of what it initially started out to be, is basically a separate window outside the browser in which you'd select, you know, oh, I want to perform a rename variable, and you'd have to then select, you know, which class and which variable, and enter in your new name. And of course, nobody used that because it's just not, you know, that good of a way to work with. You know, you shouldn't have to go to another window just to rename a variable. So,
Early on, you find out that usability issues are a lot bigger barrier to refactoring than you would think. I mean, because we found in our own experience, you know, we wrote the tool and we were pretty confident in it, but that because we had to switch windows, we didn't use it very often.
What's interesting, I think, is there's a kind of a controversial moment with VisualWorks when the RB was introduced, because prior to that, the tools were heading in a direction where they were all network enabled, and apparently some people had put a lot of effort into that, and then the refactoring browser is completely different code base. Not network-enabled at all. In fact, the only hint that anybody had ever thought about maybe making it network-enabled is that if you open up the RB, the very first item on the list in the packages is local image, sort of hinting that maybe there's more than one image.
So, you know, that was just one of those things because, well, the RB existed before, you know, 5i. I think the first version was, you know, VisualWorks 2. You know, and that was just the idea for that was that, you know, we need to make a better browser to get people interested in it. So we built all this extra functionality in there, you know, to make a better browser, and, you know, also include refactoring just to get, once you get people to download your browser, you then hook them with what you really wanted them to get anyway. And so, you know, we had to build all these other browsers. We couldn't just use the standalone browser and plug our tools in. So,
yeah, you have to realize that back then, the RB was being picked up fairly commonly by an awful lot of Smalltalkers in 2.5 and 3.0, certainly, and 3.1. That was basically the power user's browser that I remember most people who knew what they were doing were using. And then we got to 5i, and there was no RB for 5i, and that was where the tools kind of went in the direction that Michael was talking about. If you got to 5i.2, you could load some support to do remote browsing through via OpenTalk. But while that was cool, the thing after that people who've been with VisualWorks for a while will remember is that the 5i browsers, and I'm sure you guys both remember this, were pretty atrocious. I mean, the best you could say is that by the time you got to 5i.4, the browser kind of sucked less.
And so that was, you know, when we got pulled in, you know, basically from ThinkCom to build the browser, we kind of asked about whether we need to support, you know, this new way of, you know, OpenTalk or whatever it was, you know, for the browsing, and the response was we didn't need to. So that's the reason why it doesn't exist. And
the kind of ironic thing is that architecturally, the browser could do that, because the RB basically works and browses its own model. It just so happens that model is one-to-one with the traditional VisualWorks model of classes and methods and so forth. And so if someone were ambitious enough to actually build a model that would work over, you know, a network, then the RB is pretty much already set up to browse it.
Right. So in terms of refactoring, some of the stuff that I find the most useful is the most mundane and common stuff, like renames. And occasionally I use the rewrite tool as well, very useful. That's not really refactoring, but still the same sort of realm. I very rarely extract method, but I know a lot of people do extract method all the time.
Well, I use that feature constantly, actually.
Well, I think the reason I don't like doing it is because it ends up reformatting my code, and I really don't like that.
They're advertising how small your mind is.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, well, no, that's I'm glad you said that, because I'll have to use that line with Michael again in the future.
the real problem, and this is something that we've harped on for a while, and unfortunately, I think the browser is getting that direction, and the flame wars that manifest over which formatter to drop in sort of expose this. The fact is that code is no longer two-dimensional text. Actually, it hasn't been for years. And that really what your code is that object, that AST underneath. I mean, that's what we're manipulating when we refactor it, and it's what you compile when you compile it. It's what you search when you search. And so what you really need to do is to get to the point where we can store just that, you know, instead of text, and every person can stick their own formatter on top of that.
The other thing is to be able to annotate it, too. So if you want to add your comments, you don't add comments in the middle of your source. You basically attach a comment onto your source.
So the mental model would be like your Microsoft Word annotations that you stick, you know, at a point in a document you associate with a word or a paragraph or whatever, rather than the coincidental location of a comment in a particular representation, source representation of your program.
Okay, so if we had annotations like that, how would somebody see them?
That is up to them. I mean, that would be part of the formatting of the code. So one of the perennial problems that we have with refactoring is comments, because every compiler, parsing, scanning thing I've ever seen basically treats comments as white space. You know, they don't matter, because traditionally parsing has been in the realm of compilers, and compilers don't care about comments. Well, when you start moving pieces of code around and there's a comment nearby, the question then immediately arises, well, does that comment go with it? If I do a rename, do I rename parts inside the comment? If I do an extract method, does it go over there or stay over here? Is it referring to the next item, the previous item, the next block of code? You know, that is ambiguous given just simply the juxtaposition of that text. And so what you want then is a programming language or programming system that allows you to attach that comment to an object, and then your formatter or your display system can decide, oh, method comments need to always go right after the name of the function, like they do in traditional Smalltalk, or variable comments need to go right after the variable, and so forth.
So this
or
whole...
Or you can have a display like, you know, way I'd probably set it up is to be like the yellow highlight, and if I mouse over it, you know, do a little pop-up window. You know, that's another way to view the comment.
That's definitely like the word annotations, that is. I wonder, because you say that it would be a good goal to allow people to write their own formatters and just plug them in so that everybody can just see it the way they want to see it. But and we kind of tried to go in that direction with the RB and auto-formatting on Vue and all that kind of stuff. But we quickly kind of discovered that we could never get the formatter right for anyone, and people were very reluctant to modify the formatter themselves.
Yeah,
we've
had this discussion with several people. You know, essentially, people either say, okay, you know, use the refactoring browser early on, they'll use it. You know, you had the people that liked it and the people that hated it just because of the formatter. People that hated it then always said, you know, oh, it should format this way. And we'd, you know, start going through their list of rules of, okay, what about this case or that case? And they always came up inconsistent with each other. You know, you'd have one rule that said, oh, you know, there should be one space empty line after a method, but then they'd come along and say, well, in this case, there shouldn't be an empty line there. And you know, nobody could ever explain their reasoning for, you know, why they formatted their whole, you know, if you just went through all their code, why they formatted it that way.
Well, you know, when you get into formatting, you realize that in languages other than Smalltalk, there have been long and bloody civil war, you know, religious wars, actually, over things like formatting.
Yeah, does your curly bracket begin at the start of the line or at the end of the...
Exactly. I mean, people have gone... You can find threads in various news groups and chat channels that go on for almost years on that topic.
And the thing is, and my argument in the way the original formatter was set up, is that you make a reasonable default, and then you just basically don't let people change it and tell them to live with it or go someplace else. I mean, my example would be like a windowing system. I think the close button should be in the upper left. Okay, Windows obviously thinks that the close button should be in the upper right and doesn't really give me the option to move it. Now, granted, I can hack the system, but did you see my point? Whenever we get away from the idea of programs as text, then the idea of my artistic expression is how I space my keywords kind of starts to disappear into just the idea of keeping my program correct and, well, easy to understand.
The current version of the formatter, at least in the builds of 7.7, kind of works, I think, the way you're talking about it. It changes the display of how you're looking at the code, but it doesn't actually save the code in the format you're looking at. I mean, you can format the code however the heck you want, and then you can turn on the formatter to change the way it's going to look, but changing the formatter, you know, changing that setting in the formatter doesn't change the way it's saved. It just changes the way it's displaying to you.
Right, and that's the direction I think the future lies in all.
You know, for me, a lot of times, you know, I got used to, oh, it formats this way, and if I type in a new method, I'd never do formatting or anything. You know, a lot of people, you know, make sure it's tabbed in. You know, we started the block, tab it in one more tab or whatever. I just type it in, hit format on it, and I know kind of what the outlook of, you know, what the structure of that method should look like. Then I could tell real quickly whether I missed a period here or there because, oh, the structure doesn't match what I think it should match. And so I got used to, you know, just how that formatted and what the structure looks like. And so, you know, after you've done that, then it's great.
Let me take this in a slightly different direction. There's the in the refactoring browser, there's that rewrite engine, and I've done a few screencasts on it. And to be honest, when I've done screencasts on it, I've had to add a cheat cheat sheet of the of pages explaining exactly what I'm trying to do. Where did the syntax for that come from? Because for the life of me, I mean, I'm not really trying to criticize. I'm just saying for the life of me, I can't figure out how what that stuff means.
You wouldn't want to use the previous version.
so the previous version, we had not written our own scanners or parsers yet. We were using the VisualWorks one. And so we turned on the extended syntax and we were able then to use the underscore.
Yeah, back then, underscore wasn't allowed in like a name of a variable.
Right.
So we hooked, you know, and there was, you know, an option for the extended syntax, which lets you use the underscore in variable. So we hooked that, and instead of the back quotes, we used underscore as the first character meant it as a pattern variable. Then, like, the characters 2, 3, and 4 also meant special, you know, oh, if it's underscore is the second variable, that meant recurse into, so that's equivalent to the second back tick and the, and, you know, so on. So we had one per list and stuff like that. So that was the first version of that syntax. So it was, you know, underscore and any of the first four places meant something. Then, so the next thing was, okay, so we want to get rid of underscore in, you know, the first four locations. So what can we do? And you look down at your keyboard and you look for whatever key that I can type that isn't already taken for something. And the back tick is the only thing that on, you know, the standard US keyboard that Smalltalk can't use for something else already. So that's
and
where
it's
that.
Also, and it's also a little bit of a shout out to the Lisp community. They know immediately what it means because Lisp macros use the back quote for exactly the same reason that we do.
Yeah, I remember I was asking Dave Buck once to help me with a rewrite rule, and his comment to me was something like, just keep hitting back quote until it works.
So, there's an ad in there sometimes.
You know, then it's just, okay, what do you do to get the, you have, you know, the different features of, oh, you want to recurse down into this match. You know, you start looking at those features, and you just say, what does it mean? You know, how can I add that to my syntax? So that's where most of that came from. So at, I think, the list, and, you know, so, oh, what do we do for list? Well, you know, so.
So basically, a lot of this is that you didn't want to get into some of the nonsense you see in languages like C++, where you have characters that mean different things based on context. You wanted to use a set of keyboard stuff that wouldn't have meaning elsewhere in Smalltalk.
And so you could, you know, being no meaning in Smalltalk, so anything begins with a back quote, had no meaning, you know, you can't use a back quote in Smalltalk, so that's the first thing then, you know, oh, we didn't want to make it so that, oh, you had to have a string of five characters, and the first one meant this, and the second one meant something else, because, you know, then it just gets hard to read, because, especially if you're not on a fixed-width font, you know, oh, the first character from the second character, and
the other thing, too, is if you go out and look at other systems that have these kind of AST rewrite types of things, a lot of them have to go to basically a completely different language to write their match. I mean, we've seen one that, or seen several that are kind of Lisp-like, and so, you know, you write your match in little snippets of this other language. And our goal in our syntax was to basically make it exactly like the target language, exactly like Smalltalk, with a couple of extensions. And so that, in theory, this doesn't work out in practice, in theory, if you know how to write in Smalltalk, you can at least start to write your patterns in our matching language.
Okay. Now, you guys have used this for some fairly heavy lifting stuff, too. There have been things you've done where you've used the refactoring browser and the rewrite rules in order to generate basically a language, if you will, to translate from, say, one Smalltalk to another. You know, for instance, I'm pretty sure you've taken applications written in VSE and brought them to other Smalltalks.
Yeah, so there's been a bunch of projects done by Synchrony Systems that, you know, took from VSE to Visual Age or whatever, and Synchrony uses basically the parser rewriter stuff for those projects, so.
So for the most part, their tool is kind of like a thin wrapper over what's already there?
They have a bunch of other things for, you know, migrating GUI elements and, you know, that'd be tough to do with rewrites.
Okay. Yeah, I expect things like parts, for instance, would be a pain in the neck.
Yeah. they have like their whole framework layer to, you know, deal with parts applications and window builder applications and, you know.
I was wondering, what are you guys doing now? What's next?
So the thing we're doing a lot of right now, we went beyond the refactoring browsers parsing stuff, and we developed SMAC, which is, takeoff on on Yak. It was started off to basically being just a parser generator system that we wrote ourselves in Smalltalk. And the idea was that we want to be able to generate parsers, and we want those parsers to be nice for us. And by nice, we mean we want parsers that are object-oriented in terms of the internal objects, but also keep track of source so that we can do basically program transformations in using the generated parsers. Okay, so we started off with that, and now we've taken it and used that as a basis for an entire transformation system where we can take our current project, take a grammar for a language such as Delphi, which is basically Turbo Pascal 2K9 or whatever, and parse that in, add rewrites on top of that, and spit out some other language. In our case, we're spitting out C#. So, you know, this is all outside the Smalltalk sphere, but it's the Smalltalk tools that we're using to do the transformation. So we could, the idea is to make it easy to write parsers parsers for any language, and to then take those and translate into any language. And if you want to think of it as the ultimate refactoring, it's switch language.
What do you do when you come across a language feature that is really difficult to represent in another language? Like, say you're starting from Smalltalk and converting to Pascal, and they don't have closures. What do you do?
And we get nothing. Different projects.
But actually, they have inner methods which could basically do what closures do.
Yeah, but that's a bit like saying, okay, we're going to convert to Java. Let's use iter classes, and now none of the code's ever going to be readable ever again.
Right, and well, we try to make sure that we're idiomatic on a lot of stuff. So, yeah, it's not how, for example, the one we're working on right now, the code that we generate looks like Pascal a lot of times because it's not how you would write it in C#. For example, in Pascal, every function has this special result variable, and so your return value is basically assigned to this variable. Well, every translated function has an added local variable named result.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that the last line is always return result.
First, the thing about this is that then we can come through after all this is done and then remove all those with, you know, a C# to C# transformation of, oh, here's how you fix all that.
Along these lines, I've been told by numerous people that Ruby is fairly hard to parse. So how do you guys deal with a language like that? I mean, is that particularly difficult, or is that just something I've heard that isn't?
We've never dealt with Ruby, so it could be.
They might be right, and they might be wrong.
Okay.
Languages in general are hard to parse. If you can't, you know, drop a grammar into Yak and push the button, then people consider that hard to parse. One thing SMAC does is its parsers are what are called GLR parsers, which basically means that given a grammar, it will try to find every possible tree that a particular piece of text could generate. And so even if the Ruby grammar is ambiguous, we should be able to generate the parse tree. Of course, there's issues where if it is really, really ambiguous, then you can end up with exponential explosion in the parsing. So it can be very slow.
What about natural language then, like parsing English?
If you give me a grammar, a specific grammar for it, we could probably parse it. But
you know, the whole trick comes down to stuff like in C, where you know, is this a cast or is it a, you know, a function name in parentheses? You know, so you could have, you know, parentheses name, left parentheses name, right parentheses, you know, some other name. You know, right parentheses. So is that a cast or is that a function call? So, you know, stuff like that, which is really ambiguous. That's where most of your problems come in with, like, languages. So, like, C#, I think, has kind of the same problem. And most of the time for stuff we do, you know, if you're just matching stuff, it doesn't really matter. So you'll just pick one or parse them both and see which one works the best for us.
Let me ask another question that's based on some work that you did a while ago that I don't know if you've taken anywhere recently. I've seen people ask periodically about it, the Sharp Smalltalk thing you did a few years ago.
Yeah. So that just kind of started out as, I think originally we was working for a company where, you know, how do you get Smalltalk inside of this company? And, you know, so I was looking at potentially doing another project. So, you can sell .NET inside of a company, but it's harder to sell Smalltalk inside of a company. So I thought, just kind of play around with .NET and see what we can get. So we basically build a Smalltalk compiler that, compiles to the .NET codes. We got it where I think it runs most of the test suite that was from the first Camp Smalltalk. And then it could run a web server and a few things like that. However, we just, never have really continued it because it's, we haven't got paying work out of it. If you're working on something else that's paying you, you'll work on it.
Would it be a matter of, how Dave Simmons ended up getting hired by Microsoft because of his Smalltalk work with .NET? If Microsoft had thrown money at you, would you have continued it?
It all depends on how much money.
So I'm more curious about one small tech aspect of that. That was obviously done before the whole dynamic language runtime thing was added by Microsoft. Were there any particular challenges to getting Smalltalk to run on that? Was it dramatically slower or not much slower?
So the benchmarks, it appeared that, if you're running just general Smalltalk code, we were around the same speed as Dolphin. So we're faster than Squeak, but, slower than VisualWorks. If you do, just purely small integer stuff, you get killed by everybody because we had to box all our small integers, so you create an object for each small integer. So if you do, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus, like that, you're creating a new object each time. So you get killed on anything small integer, but then anything else, you get picked up by, you have a JIT that Microsoft has. So, it's probably, you're picking up all your stuff, but you're losing off against Dolphin, so you end up being about as quick as Dolphin. As far as the tricks go, there wasn't too much tricky stuff except that essentially whenever you get an object to or from .NET, if it's in Smalltalk, you know what type it's going to be. Anything to or from .NET, you kind of have, who knows what type of object that is, so you have to convert it into the Smalltalk object. So if you called a function that returned an integer, but, it was typed as returning object, you basically anything typed as returning object, you'd have to test the return value to see, if it's an integer, then make it a Smalltalk integer. If it's a collection, a list, make it an ordered collection or something like that. So that was all the tricks of just putting in all that code whenever you compiled. The other trick was hacking exceptions to do non-local returns out of blocks, in which .NET likes to have some functions that catch all exceptions and throws it as some other exception. So that was nice on those because, you throw your non-local return exception, then .NET would catch it and throw some other exception, which then you had to get the original non-local return that you wanted thrown and throw it again. But most of that, had, free time 1 month and started working on it, and a lot of the whole just building up the .NET stuff was done in a month's time or so to make it where I could compile Smalltalk into .NET.
Okay.
I think this was during the last economic downturn around 2000 that did this.
2003, I think so.
So, yeah. So now would be the perfect time to pick it back up, huh?
No, I've kept them employed during this downturn.
So maybe next year, I don't know yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So if people are looking to have this, any of the stuff you've been talking about with SMAC and translation done, where do people find you? What's the best URL people can use to track you guys down?
So right now we don't have the latest, the latest SMAC anywhere. By Oopsla we will, because we're going to do a demo at Oopsla, but right now we don't have the latest anywhere. It's something that we started working on just because, whenever you build something for yourself versus build something that the public consumes, you always have to, you know, okay, we can live with some warts here and there, but most of the time I prefer to take those off before I throw it out for the general public, because the warts you know about and then the warts you don't know about will add up enough for the general public to either like it or not like it, you know. So
you can just ask Michael. I leave all those warts in my code.
Yeah. Remember testing one of the, I think it was an S-unit runner or something, where the first test I hit, I was trying to send out to something, you know, in which somebody's test framework or, you know, had their image loaded without, I guess, writing through the transcript or something. And, of course, I didn't have that one in there, and it, I just ended up with hundreds and hundreds of walkback windows opening up just because the out wasn't. So, you know, stuff like that will have an effect on whether you want to use that product or not in the future. So I prefer to if I can.
Yeah, it's probably a bad sign when you try it the first time and hundreds of windows open up. That tends to be a turnoff.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks. You wanted to thank both you guys for coming on the podcast. It's been great.
Yeah, thanks very much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. While reviewing some code recently, I came across a superclass that defined an instance variable, but the subclasses used that variable for completely different things. One subclass used the variable to hold a stream and sent stream messages to it, while another used it to hold a drawing context and sent drawing messages to it. The superclass didn't reference the variable at all. Any methods that would have referred to the variable were left for the subclasses to implement. This means that the variable isn't really the same variable at all. I'd rather move the variable down into the subclasses and call the variables more specific names. There's no value in making it an instance variable of the superclass if you can't share any methods that reference that variable. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. After a dry spell, we have 5 new positions from around the world to report on this week. But first, a Smalltalk Jobs database success story. Carl Gundel is known in the Smalltalk community and beyond as the creator of Liberty Basic and Run Basic, both of which are written in VisualWorks. Unfortunately, for the past few years, Carl has had to make his living doing Java programming. Thanks to a position he heard about on this podcast segment and information we had in the Smalltalk Jobs database, Carl's commute went from 1.25 hours to just 20 minutes. And now his day job once again revolves around programming and Smalltalk. Congratulations, Carl. You too may have the same opportunity as Carl, thanks to the following positions that were added to the database this week. Irene Thacker, our contributor in India, reports that in Bangalore, MySys India has a permanent position for a software engineer who has experience with Smalltalk, Ruby, Python, and/or C++/Java, which is J2EE, and C#.NET. Singapore. Capita has a 1 to 2 year contract for a systems analyst, IT analyst, who has a wide range of programming knowledge and experience that includes Smalltalk. In the USA, Peachtree City, Georgia, near Atlanta, Intigy and NAM Info Inc. are looking for a Smalltalk developer who has experience with Visual Age Smalltalk 6.1. This is a contract to hire position. Columbus, Ohio, CDI Corporation, CorpToCorp.com, Alexon Services Corp., and Procyon Inc. are all trying to do a quick hire for an 8-month contract. They are looking for a Smalltalk application developer who also has experience with DB2 and the gas industry. Minneapolis, Minnesota. TEK Systems has a long-term contract for a Smalltalk developer who has experience with VisualWorks, Oracle, and the telephony industry. This may be a conversion project away from Smalltalk, but the job postings are a bit unclear on this. The jobs listed in this report are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit our public directory page at xrl.us/smalltalkjobs, or read my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.